Do you eat, sleep, and breathe golf? Do you love to explore? And most importantly, do you just want to have some fun? Well, then welcome to Talking Golf Getaways with Mitch and Darren. Now here's the guy with all the questions, Mitch Lawrence, and the guy with all the answers, Darren Bunch.
Hello and welcome once again to Talking Golf Getaways with Mitch and Darren. I'm Mitch Lawrence in Myrtle Beach. Darren is out there in California. And what a great, great way to get into season two of Talking Golf Getaways, because from Hong Kong, we will be speaking to the great Adam Ralston, who is now safely ensconced somewhere in Hong Kong after spending 80 days crossing Mongolia on his epic golf journey, the longest hole. Darren, I don't know what else to say, but you and I have been following this since the inception of it. And how great it is to have Adam standing by and ready to fill us in on part two of his longest hole journey.
Oh, what an incredible journey it was. And so many stories out of it that he told us in the first installment when he was just halfway through the journey. Can't wait to hear the rest of the journey and all the different stories that have come out of that. It's going to be a fun few minutes or half hour or 2 hours, however long it takes.
I think it's going to be more than a few minutes. We're glad you found us, as always, golfnewsnet.com, iTunes Podcasts, Audio Boom, Stitcher. Darren, you can find on social media, at Getaways Golf on Twitter, at Golf Getaways on Instagram. Me, you can find on both, at Mitch Lawrence, L-A-U-R-A-N-C-E. For those of you who, shame on you, may have missed our first installment with Adam, this is just a quick run-through. Teeing off at 1 a.m. on the 29th of June. Adam's going to relive this. He's going to start to go back now. From the base camp at Khuiten Peak, the highest and most western point in Mongolia, Adam took the first of, get this, 20,093 shots. And then he and his partner, his faithful friend, his most unusual caddy, Ron Rutland, took their first steps on a world record-setting journey of 80 days and nights, covering 1,249.6 miles, not to be too specific, which led to the 18th hole at Mount Bagd Golf Club in Ulaanbaatar, a journey known for obvious and perfect reasons as the longest hole. They were joined at different points along the way by their photographer and videographer, Andrew King, and shortly after they began by Yubi the Wonder Dog, who we'll get to also in this conversation, all in the name of adventure and the most worthwhile of charitable causes, carrying the spirit of Laureus, the Sport for Good Foundation, and the South African Golf Development Board as they went. You can find out all about it on their website, if you haven't done that yet, thelongesthole.com, or on their absolutely spectacular Instagram account, at thelongesthole. And it's been the last time we talked to Adam, it was about 2 months ago, and we have been, Darren and I were talking about how we've been looking forward to the time when we can have this experience from Hong Kong. Welcome, Adam, once again to Talking Golf Getaways. It's great to have you safe and here with us.
It's great. It's great to be back on the show again. Thanks, guys.
All right. Last time we talked to you, and as we said, you and Ron and Yubi were about halfway through the longest hole. You finished the journey on September 17th, so you've had about a month to reflect on and enjoy the incredible feat that you and Ron and Yubi accomplished. Can you, if it's possible, can you share a few of what must be thousands of thoughts that you've had about this amazing experience?
Well, yeah, I probably only had about 9 or 10 days before I had to head back, or we had to head to South Africa to, you know, to sort of round up all the sponsors, and we had a golf day. So I've only actually just got back to Hong Kong on Thursday, and, you know, had like an extended period of time of relaxation since the end of it. But I think it's more the sense of accomplishment, or, you know, when you set out to do something as extreme as this, and then you complete it, it's like I did a BBC interview before I went on the trip. So BBC World Service interviewed me, and we talked about how many kilometers we have to achieve per day, and you know, the vast wilderness, and, you know, it was sort of the unknown, and I was talking about what we were going to do, and then one day before the finish, they called me up again, and we relived, you know, part of that interview, and it was, I could hear myself talking about, you know, how many kilometers we had to achieve, and how many shots we're going to play, and how I'm going to play by the rules and the spirit of the game, and then I got interviewed, you know, post, and it was just really, really, it just put everything into perspective that I actually achieved what I set out to achieve. And that was probably the most gratifying feeling of the whole trip, is the realization that you actually achieved something quite special.
Did it seem, really amazing to you? Is it almost an out of body, like you were talking about somebody else kind of?
Yeah, it's because I'm going through. I've got 2 terabytes worth of footage. I think it's something like 68 hours of GoPro, Sony G3X, like all the sort of variety of cameras that we had with us, and just reflecting back on some of the footage is just crazy. Like, I can't even remember shooting, you know, in the first 2-3 weeks, and just reliving it and just going like, it's putting little bricks together. You know, you're building this house slowly over 80 days, you know, and you don't remember each brick. Like, and now I'm able to go onto my laptop and some of the moments, you just almost have to laugh. Like, I can't believe we went through those days in the beginning, and through the desert, and you know what I mean? It's pretty surreal.
Adam, we're going to talk about a lot of stuff, but one thing had popped into my mind, and this was a question I had for you on the last one, and I kind of waited to ask it until you were completely done. Do you have a single, besides the final putt, which we're going to get to, do you have a single shot that just was either your most favorite or most challenging of all, you know, 2,093 shots, which, by the way, sounds like just a regular round of golf for Mitch.
Yeah, so I actually do have one shot that stands out that is like, I actually call it the greatest shot of all time in the history of golf. And it was actually probably about two weeks. No, it's about a week after I spoke to you guys. We came out of out of Bayern Encore into what is called the Hungai Mountains, and we came over this ridge. And if you can imagine, you're at altitude. So the 3 days before, we were climbing, and we came around this corner, and it dropped down into this big valley with alpine forests, and it was amazing. It was almost like we knew that it was, the line on the ground was like, this is a new part of Mongolia, if you know what I mean. And to get down to this valley, the road slalomed like maybe 12 times on itself, if you can imagine. You know, like it goes along and then turns really sharply on itself and then goes back again. So if you can imagine, I'm going to have to hit a golf ball like 12 laps back and forward down this gravelly path. And so we started going down this sort of narrow pathway with all these rocks, and Ron's struggling with the cart. It's really steep, and I'm chipping, and maybe every 10 shots, the ball ricochets and goes down the slope, and I've got to climb down this vertical slope and play back up onto the path. And it was just misery. Like, I was pulling my hair out, but I got to the elbow of the first path, and I could see the bridge like 200 meters below us. But I was clearing like a huge forest, and it was a crazy shot, but it would save me probably, you know, 200-300 shots going slaloming. So I took out like a 7-iron. We were really high up, and I just struck this 7-iron. I landed square on the bridge. Like miles down. I could see the bridge was literally surrounded by trees. So it's the only thing I could see. And Ron had gone ahead and pulled the cart, and Andrew was with me. And I just struck probably the best 7-iron of my life. all the way down it, and we could see it land on the bridge, and we were just like standing there together, like that was insane. Because otherwise, if I couldn't find it, I'd have to come all the way back up. So right. we could see the ball, and so we were like, right, so that's fine. We've done that, and then we jogged down the hill. So that was the greatest shot I played, definitely.
All right, and obviously Andrew was there, and you had all this other equipment, so we're going to get to see it.
About that.
Oh, no.
yeah, that's it. So, we had an issue with that day's filming. So that one shot is not actually recorded. So, so out of all the footage,
it was the greatest shot ever.
Of all time. Yeah. The greatest shot of all time. Sorry, people, hasn't been recorded.
Oh. All right, that's all right. We never saw anything old Tom Morris hit, or you know,
exactly.
That's fine. Anyway. It'll go down in the annals. So I always everything now when I think about your journey in golf, I have to relate to you playing now, and I'm picturing you with your buddies. You're out to foursome. You're playing some what they consider to be a really hard golf course, and there's some shot into a green, and they're all going, man, this is, wow, what a tough pin, or whatever they're going to say. And you just standing there thinking about the shot you just described and thinking there is no such thing as a tough shot anymore. There can't be anything as a tough shot.
It's very different. Obviously, like I've learned to hit, like when you have an 8-iron in your hand for 2 weeks, you learn to hit shots that, like, you learn to, you know, manipulate the ball differently. You chip it around, you're hitting shots between, you know, your full spectrum of shots. And like when you get to a normal golf club, which I did in South Africa, like when you pick up like a 4-iron again, it feels like it's about 3 meters long. Like right. you're so used to hitting something the same length for so long that like I said, like you pick up a driver and you're like, geez, that feels like a crutch. You know what I mean? It's like so long and heavy. And so I'm not a better golfer. I'm a worse golfer for it. But if you give me an 8-iron, I could probably hit it. You know, my distance control is pretty good. Like being able to, you know, hit a variety of shots with an 8 and a 7-iron. But when it comes to actually playing and chipping and putting, like I'm far worse for it.
So we're going to call you Sevi from now on. We'll just call you Sevi.
I could probably play better with just like a driver and a couple of, you know, mid irons. I'd probably be better for it.
You know that they had for years, I don't know if they still have it, the World One Club Championship. I have a friend that won it.
Really?
Yeah, with a 6-iron. But if you could find your way into that and just play the 8-iron that you played across Mongolia, my money is on you.
Yeah, no, that would be a good challenge.
Oh, yeah, and you need a new challenge. Let's just talk. Darren mentioned the final putt. If people go to your Instagram account, they can see the video of you. You're on the 18th at Mount Bogd. You've come all this way, 80 days. You know that this shot is coming. You have known it for a while and about finishing. And you leave yourself, and I can't tell you how many times I watched this video over and over. And you're left with a 7-foot downhill, what was called on the video a gnarly downhill 7-foot putt on the 18th. Describe to us what that was like. Your reaction was just friggin' priceless. But describe to us that last shot of the 20,093 that you hit.
Well, before I describe that, I think you have to describe. I have to describe the lead up to, or the build up to that putt. Like you're playing golf 80 days with a 7 and 8 iron, and you know you're going to hit a green. One green, like you have one chance to not 3-putt. That's my thought. Like, just don't 3-putt. And on top of that, you're carrying a putter that hasn't seen air or hasn't been gripped. You know, it's been hanging off the side of a cart for the 3 months. It hasn't even been touched. So you've got this you've got this ominous thing that's looking at you every day, just saying like to you, like, do not three putt, do not three putt. So like the amount of conversations me and Ron have had, we had across Mongolia about that putt. Like I just said, I guarantee you I'll have a 7-footer and I bet you it'll be downhill. Da 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 da. Like in my life, golfing wise, my golfing life, I will three putt once or twice around. Like I'm a terrible putter for my handicap. Like I struggle on the greens. My short game isn't great. Like my long game keeps me in it. So all of this, like we find ourselves, you know, going through the long grass on the edge of the 18th hole of Mount Bocht Golf Club. And I'm hacking. It's the longest grass we could possibly, we didn't even see this long grass like in the wilderness. And I finally get onto the fairway. There's cameras everywhere. And I have like, I don't know whether you guys have actually seen the 7-iron. I need to send you guys a photo of it, but there's no grooves on it. It's caked with mud and like old grass. And it's like congealed grass juice. It's like, it's almost cement on the face of this, face of this golf club. So it's, I've got about 130 yards. And I just sort of, I bunt a 7-iron up to the front edge. I'm probably 50 feet away and I roll this. I haven't putted in ages. I'm nervous. And I roll this first putt by, like you say, to about a gnarly 7-footer down the hill. But before the putt, I actually gave my brother my phone. So it was a stroke of genius that I actually gave him my phone, and he did like a 10-minute Instagram story throughout, like to the lead up. And it was actually spectacular. So I have my brothers commentating on the video, and, in most golf courses I would have missed. And it was just, I don't know. It was a defining moment in my life, I would have to say. And it was just a very, very sweet way of ending the whole thing.
It was, and you're also, and we might mention it again, you have to go to the Instagram account and see this. I was wondering who was doing the commentary, because as I listened to it, you're alternately feeling the what must have been incredible, well, a mix of every emotion you can think of. And he's doing the commentary, and I was kind of laughing a little bit because I'm picturing that going on. And you're there, and you're in what I assume is kind of traditional Mongolian garb. You and Ron.
Yeah, that's it. So we started as golfers, and we sort of felt like we ended as Mongolians in the end. So it was a sort of, I think it was quite a fitting way of finishing.
But when you finished, I mean, the fist pump and the kind of emotion of that second after it went down, did it feel like what you pictured winning a major is like?
Like, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, I've created this like as my own major. Like I was able to feel the pressure and overcome it. Like I've never actually done that on a golf course in a golf tournament. And to do it in front of so many people and not to just tap in, you know, a tap in three putt, like I still would have, it would have just been another number, but to finish like that, all golfers know you want to roll that putt in. You don't want to finish on a, you know, a tap in three putt to win the Open. You know, you want to do it in style. And yeah, I feel like it felt like winning something like that, as close to.
Well, I'll never look at it. I don't know how Darren feels. I'll never look at anybody winning a major and saying this was a tough 4 days again and have anywhere near the respect for them that I do for you after what you went through. Is there a Mongolian claret jug?
I don't think so.
Oh, we should have one for you.
Yeah, somebody should have given you some kind of trophy or something to at least drink some sort of alcohol out of you're standing on the tee. I mean, on the green.
I drank some milk out of like a little like vase they gave me afterwards. I think it's in the video.
It is in the video. I was wondering what it was. I was saying, I'm really hoping that it's something that Adam really enjoys.
All right, Adam, let's get to the part that's going to make us all teary-eyed and sobbing, and I'm sure. But talk a little about UB and what ended up happening with him, and just, you know, kind of recap for people who maybe didn't listen to the other one, you know, what an impact he had on the trip itself.
Big time. So, like I said before, I was going through some of the footage, and he came day two, or I think it was day three morning. We were in the White River Valley, freezing ourselves, and this dog sort of stumbled along and was crying, and he joined us, followed us for about 60 kilometers before we started feeding him. And he, you know, guys, he was so skinny. Like I looked at this video, and he's so, like, his back legs are so skinny. And anyway, he ended up following us through the whole journey. So 2000 kilometers, or like you guys said, 1,200 miles, and became part of our team. He, you know, defended the cart. We were able to be very portable. We could leave him underneath the cart. He, you know, he would, like I say, defend it. We could go to towns, go get supplies, come back. And he just, yeah, I loved the dog so much. He was, you know, such a great part of our adventure, and added so much. But obviously, well, he's an old dog. He's about 10 years old, we reckon, maybe even 11. A real hardy, big wolf. And I knew that he wouldn't be able to come back to Hong Kong because of the change. You know, it just wouldn't be fair. He's a sort of Mongolian. He's a Mongolian purebred dog, I found out. He's actually a breed of Mongolian dog. And he's renowned. The breed is renowned for being like a wild animal, if you know what I mean. So they're able to look after themselves, like hunt for themselves and just roam. So it was quite cool. Like I described it as almost being friends with like a UFC fighter. You know, he's like really, really good friend. You're friends with him, like you love him, but other people think like, what the hell are you doing with him? Cause he's a nutter. Do you know what I mean? But, sure. But he's like your best mate. So this is our relationship grew real strong. Like he, you know, I was, you know, his best mate. And so, coming with the last sort of 2-3 weeks, we had to find him a home, and many people on Facebook wanted to take him in Mongolia, which was really cool. Like a lot of Mongolians came out of the woodwork saying like, I would love to take on your dog. So we had probably 3 or 4 places lined up, in order, you know, that wanted to take him. So when that last putt rolled in on 18, as much as it was a success, like a, you know, a feeling of, you know, this adventure's finished and how amazing it is with all my friends and family there. But in the back of my mind, we had to find this dog a really nice home. So, we finished on 18. It's so weird, you know, it's probably the same as when someone wins the Open or something like that. There's this lull where you're still like, you know, what do you do with your golf bag and all these little things, like what do you do with the cart, and you still have to go for a shower and, you know, all these little things. So we have this dog now, like a big dog at a golf club, and we have the cart. So we wheel him round the back, and he's just going to lie under this cart, and it feels like we're celebrating, but the dog doesn't know what he's doing. And it's quite heartbreaking, you know, and it's quite distressing. And I don't know what to do, because we're staying in a hotel in Ulaanbaatar at night, and the whole thing, you're used to your routine and he's used to your routine, putting up the tent and stuff, has just vanished. You know, we have a big dinner and stuff like that, and he stays under the cart overnight at the golf club. We head it back into town. And so there's this moment where we all get into a bus, and I think it's the time where he realizes the cart isn't home anymore. It's me that's the home, you know? So I'm actually getting quite emotional talking about it. So he then runs up to like the side of the cart, like the side of the bus, and everyone's there just like watching him. And so the cart's left at the golf club and we have to just drive into town. And it's like quite, you know, it's quite, so he's standing at the doorway and we just have to close the door and leave him. Oh. And it's, yeah, it's pretty grim. And then we then have a big night out, like a big night out in town. And in the morning, we go back up to the golf club. And I actually had an interview at one of the morning shows in Mongolia at 9 a.m., super hungover. so it was quite a mission, like got up at 8:49. I had to be on TV at 9. So I had to run across the road in a shirt and get it done. Anyway, we got into a, well, Ron and Andrew King had to go to the golf club and try and round up UB and trying to get him into a car to take him to the home that he was gonna live at. And they couldn't find him anywhere. And finally, after about half an hour, they found him sort of wandering around the golf club. And he was howling and crying, and it was just like super miserable. Yeah, and they couldn't get him into the car, so they gave up on that. So they left the dog at the golf club. Andrew got the motorbike and rode the motorbike to the guy's house, and the guy's house was like an allotment in the city. So it was, I mean, it mustn't have been bigger than, you know, I would say 300 square meters. Barricaded, you know, like walled allotment with a Gur camp. And it was just, you know, this dog was going to be chained up for the rest of his life in this place. And so we just scrapped it all. We just said, no chance. We're not giving him away to any of these people. So we ended up going to the golf club and ordering a bus with no seats in it. So, you know, like a transit van. And we lured the dog into the transit van. My girlfriend was there. And we changed the plan, which was the most inspirational thing I've probably done the whole trip. We changed the plan. And we all went to the national park for the day because everyone had, all my friends and family had only seen Ulaanbaatar, the city. So we ended up going 2 or 3 hours out of Ulaanbaatar to see the national park, which is a beautiful national park called Terej National Park. And everyone stayed in a big Gur camp there. So, you know, this beautiful valley with, I think, about 15 of these white little Gurs. Everyone had their own one. And so me, Andrew, and Ron, and Merrill, my girlfriend, got Yubi into this transit van, and we brought him to the Gur camp in the national park, thinking that maybe we could find him a home there, you know? Maybe there might be someone that would take him on. And, you know, he was running around really, really happy. And at the foothill of this valley was this really nice, like, I don't know, a couple of acres of land fenced off, a Gur. And what we could see was maybe a couple of goats and stuff. So me, Andrew King, and the translator with UB wandered, we wandered down to this guy's house thinking maybe this guy might take him on. It's the most perfect place. So it's like a nice, you know, the white picket fence. It was awesome. And we went in there. This old man was there. He was about 55, 60. And we sat him down in his Gur and he poured us tea. And the dog was sort of sleeping outside. And we just said to him, you know, we have this dog. He's, you know, super famous in Mongolia now. He's, you know, he's a true nomad. His story is incredible. And we sat down with an iPad and we flicked through his whole journey throughout the whole trip, pictures of the dog. You know, this is him in the Gobi. This is him in, you know, single, like a town. And the guy recognized the towns and he was completely taken aback by this dog's journey. And before we even said anything, he said, you know what, I think, you know, this is a gift from God. You know, you guys coming to visit me, and if you guys want me to take the dog, it would be a complete pleasure, and like it would be an honor for us to take the dog on. So we were like literally over the moon, super emotional, and the next morning we took the dog down to this awesome little this little place, and the guy was already building like a little house for him in the corner of his place. And yeah, it was really, really emotional letting the dog go. And to be fair to the boy, he actually made it very easy for us to leave him, thank God, or it would have been a real mess. So the guy knocked in a peg in the ground, obviously, because he doesn't know it's his new home. And we tied him up, said goodbye. And I think I handed the guy about $700 US. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just to make sure that, you know, this is like, as much as the guy knew it meant so, you know, UV meant so much to me and Ron and everyone else who was there, you know, there was about 15 other people who were also super emotional about the dog leaving. So it was just, the money was, it was more of just a gesture to say like, this dog means so much to us and please look after him. And yeah, so it was a really, really nice story to finish. So we have the awesome putt and the, you know, the dog getting a good home. So that was a really, really nice feeling.
Do you have people along the way now, including the person who took UB, who you think you'll be in touch with for the rest of your life?
It would be more the people that aided us, like Bat, who's from Mongolian Trekking, and all his team. You know, those are the guys that were, you know, these guys are incredible. I mentioned before, you know, when we were planning the trip, they just know Mongolia like the back of their hand, or if they don't know an area, they just call up a mate that does. And so these guys were like our, you know, our ears or our eyes in terms of our planning. And then also, you know, during the trip, we would say, Bat, do you think you could send, you know, more gas to this place? And so in 2 days' time, we would end up, you know, getting into town and the gas canisters would be at someone's house. So, I mean, these guys would be the guys that we'd be, you know, most fond of. In Mongolia, we would meet fantastic people, but we would only see them for 1 or 2 days. So the connection wouldn't be so strong. So you would meet fantastic people, you just wouldn't.
And do you think you'll go back?
Of course, I'll go back and see UB. So the actual Gur camp that he's at, the caretaker is the only person in the valley that stays there all year round and looks after all the Gur camps. So it was just so unbelievably lucky that we found that one person in the valley that stays there all year round and has a connection with the Gur camp that Bat the tour guide has that connection with that Gur camp. So he sends tourists to this one Gur camp that he will then be able to send us photos of the dog, which is such a cool connection to have. And then the Gur camp also gives the scraps to the dog. So it's like, it was a really cool finish.
Well, you mentioned luck. I don't think there's any luck involved. It's like your last putt. I think there's perfect endings. I just want to touch on one thing before we let you go. We could literally, I feel like we could do this for hours, and hopefully someday we'll get to do it in person and hear more in detail. But Darren and I, because this is a show about golf and travel, we talk a lot about buddy trips. We talk a lot about the ability through golf to have the kind of connections that you're talking about. You have what has to be a world record, literal and figurative connection and bond to Ron. I mean, you had, you know, Darren and I go on these trips and we're together for a week and great, we have fun. But you have an 80 day and more, all the planning, all the after, everything you're going to do next. With Ron, you have this amazing, amazing thing. Can you put into a relatively short amount of time and you had a connection with him already, but what this 80-day trip has been like in terms of the bonding that you and Ron did?
Yeah, like, first of all, to do what Ron did is far, far beyond what I achieved during the trip. I mean, he pulled 130 kilos mind-numbingly across 80 days. Like, just to do that without the golf would be like a headliner. You know what I mean? It's crazy what he achieved. And as the golfer, I feel like I'm the one that gets all the credit for it, if you know what I mean. Because everyone, it's traditionally, as a golfer, you're the one that hits the shots. You're the talented, commodity that, you know, wins tournaments. And so you are the one put on a pedestal. And it's sort of the same for this trip. But Ron achieved here is far, far beyond what I achieved, I think. Anyway, it's crazy to be strapped into this cart and pull 2,011 kilometers is crazy. But our relationship, we are two very different people. That's what everyone needs to realize. Like, I'm hyperactive, unorganized, and Ron is very diligent and methodical. So this trip probably wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for Ron. So it was potentially my crazy ideas and the fruition that he brings was able to, you know, dovetail so well this whole trip, from the planning to the end. Like, we planned a golf day in South Africa where all our sponsors came. You know, he was really at the coalface of all of that, getting the sponsors on board. It was crazy. But in terms of our friendship, like, we had very, very different roles in this trip. And we got on very well. We got on extremely well throughout. Like, it's crazy. Every day we get up and we do a very similar task. And it's the small things you look forward to together, like, you know, cooking dinner. And we had our own little routines. And then we would almost come together at the end of the day. It's very weird. Like, Ron would be pulling the cart along a path, and I would have to take my own path. So a lot of the time, we weren't totally together. So people must think, like, how the hell did you guys spend 80 days together? But like I said, we have our own tasks and our own routines, and then we come together at the end of the day and during lunchtime and things like that. Like, we're obviously talking, but we're not constantly at each other, which was probably the best thing.
Yeah, that makes total sense. As you're describing it, I'm picturing it in my mind, and it makes total sense to me. And it's, the whole thing is just, it's truly and obviously unbelievable. As I said, we could talk a whole lot more about it, and hopefully we will. Adam, we hope we'll come back. We do something called the Emergency 9 on Talking Golf Getaways, where we ask guests the 9 most asked golf travel questions. We're going to hold off on that because this is just its own thing. But at some point in the near future, hopefully we'll be able to get you back on again and talk to you about some of the other great golf that you've played around the world. But thank you so much for joining us, for taking the time, for keeping us posted. This has been, there's so many of us who have been on this journey with you, even in a small part. And can't thank you enough for everything you've done for all of us.
Well, thanks a lot, guys. It's been a pleasure.
Darren, parting shots?
Well, as always, we have to thank the listeners, too. We couldn't do this without them. Now in season 2, which is just unbelievable that we've done this more than a year and done more than 70-something episodes, and it's really it's kind of mind-boggling. You can hit us up on the Twitter. I'm at Getaways Golf. Mitch is at Mitch Lawrence. That's LauranceE. You can use hashtag Talking Golf Getaways, hashtag Emergency 9, hashtag 2 Haggis Bags, or hashtag Longest Hole Fans to get our attention.
I think we can use that one forever because that is definitely the truth. Adam, again, thanks for being with us. We'll be in touch with you. We'll get the information on the documentary as it comes along. We'll keep everybody posted. And hopefully I could talk to you about whatever possibly you have planned for the next. It's very tough to top what you just did. I can't even imagine the thoughts that might be running through your mind. We'll get to that on a different show. I'm glad you're fine. I'm glad Ron's fine. I'm glad UB has a great, great home. This is a fantastic story. We'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Thanks, guys. Awesome stuff.
Okay. And all of you out there, this is... Ooh. I just got emotional here. Sorry. Sorry, Dare. We always end the show. I thought you were going to get me during the UB story, Adam. But I kind of held up through that. But we always end our show, Darren and I, with Tom Petty's Running Down the Dream. And I didn't think this was going to happen, but it did. So what the hell?
We should tell people while you gather yourself there that this is the first one. This is the first episode that we've recorded. We've got a lot that'll come out between now and the end of the year, but we recorded them in the summertime and early in the fall. But this is the first episode with right here that we've done since Tom Petty passed away. And we've been using his song throughout since we started the show. We've been using Running Down the Dream, and we're going to keep using it and remember fondly Tom Petty and his music.
Thanks for saving me. that was off the cliff. That was off the emotional cliff. But certainly we've had somebody on today and we've talked to before, and Adam and Ron and all the people involved who have run down their dream in a big time way. We hope you do the same. Thanks again, Adam. Thanks again, Darren. This has been great. We look forward to talking to you again on Talking Golf Getaways. Get out there, run down a damn dream.